So our topic tonight is transport, and we're delighted to have Dr. Martin and Reverend Margot Hodgson with us to challenge us on how we travel from a biblical perspective. Martin is an environmental biologist at Oxford University and Oxford Brookes, and the operations director for the John Ray Initiative, which connects the environment, science, and Christianity. He's an assessor for the Eco Church Award, about which you should have a leaflet in your pew. He's here tonight with his wife, Margot, who is the rector of the benefice of Whitchurch Vale in Buckinghamshire. Together, they have written The Christian Guide to Environmental Issues, and those books are available at the back and the table for purchase this evening. And they speak on speak and write on all the topics that we've covered in the Lent series so far. And we're very, very grateful for you to make time in your busy schedule to come and speak with us and spend time with us this evening. So thank you. Now, Martin and Margot will speak for about 40 minutes. And after that, we have the opportunity to share some of our takeaways from the past 5 weeks. And then at about 9 o'clock, we shall have a discussion panel where we're pleased to welcome back David and Jane Fulford and Mike Turton to us, who've been our speakers for the last 2 weeks, and they will join Martin and Margot out here, and there's an opportunity for us to ask those questions that we perhaps didn't ask over the last few weeks. Now, Christine Bainbridge, who was our speaker in the first week, is unable, or second week, has got sort of clergy duties, and so she sends her apologies. Now, we always begin the evening with a prayer. So let's bow our heads and come into the presence of God. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this evening. We lift Martin and Margot to you, and we ask, Lord, that you bless them as they speak to us. But we ask also, Lord, that you give us all ears to hear what they have to say. Amen. Now, before we begin, the talk each week, we've had a song and a video to help us focus our minds and our hearts on God and his amazing creation. And tonight we're going to return to the song that we had in our first week, which is called Creation Calls, and it's written by and sung by Brian Dawkson. Can I invite Martin and Margot to come out now, and they're going to speak to us now for the next 40 minutes on the subject of transport, or Martin, sorry, anyway. So can we give Martin and Margot, please, a round of applause to welcome them here.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for inviting us to speak to you this evening on travel and transport. Margot and I do a lot of speaking on all kinds of different issues, but actually, this is the first time that we've been asked to speak on this. So this is new, and it's basically some ideas that we've been thinking about over the last few weeks since we've been asked to speak on this. Funnily enough, the organisation that I work for, the John Ray Initiative, we've decided that next year's conference is going to be on travel and transport. So it's kind of really quite useful as a sort of starter to think about these kind of issues. So how are we going to do this? Well, here's my plan. Being a scientist, I like plans. We're going to start with a little bit of general background. Then I'll look at some of the problems of transport. And of course that leads in particularly to climate issues. And then concentrate really on two areas, that's road transport and air transport, because I don't think we can do all of them this evening because it just gets too complicated. And then Margot will come and do a short, about 10-minute theological reflection at the end of this presentation. So that's the little plan. Thought I'd sort of start with reasons why people travel. Well, I started pondering the why question, and I think exercise, recreation, work, that includes things like commuting, and also work travel, where you're going to see other businesses or try to sell something, that sort of thing. Then holidays, of course, are another big category of travel, and then maybe visiting relatives and friends, which may not quite fit into the same category as holiday, or it might be. Sometimes it could be the same. But you can probably think of other things around that, but I think those are reasonable starters as to why people travel. And then we think about types of transport. Well, I started with human-powered, so we got walking, running, swimming and cycling. Then we travel are animal-powered, horse, camel, some people elephants. Other animals that you can think of that people have travelled on, but mostly in this country it's horses. And then road, and of course cyclists and pedestrians and horses do end up on roads, but there I'm thinking about the internal combustion engine and more recent inventions, motorbikes, cars, vans, lorries, etc. Rail, lots of different types of rail. Boat, we go from sail to hovercraft to big ships powered by diesel mostly. And then air, we go from balloon to glider to plane. And very few people have been up in rockets. But that's not become very common just yet, but we will see. So, types of transport, lots of different types. What are the problems of transport? Think accidents, no doubt about that. Noise, I don't think we would disagree on that. And pollution, I'm largely talking about local pollution there, and we will discuss that. But big problem nowadays, which of course is on everybody's minds, is carbon emissions. And what about the carbon emissions of transport? And we'll spend quite a bit of time looking at that. Accidents. Some good news. I did a little research on accidents, and you can see last 10 years, fatalities and serious injuries on our UK roads have declined really quite markedly. Our cars are better designed than they were, so if you do get into an accident now, you're less likely to die. Roads are getting safer. We're getting better at designing them and putting in speed bumps and all kinds of things to prevent people killing other people. And so things are getting better. We still get a lot of people killed every year, but it's going down, which is good. In terms of noise, there are lots of different types of noise, and some of it can be really annoying. But I think actually transport is really quite a major source of noise. And there we're talking about particularly road transport. If you're near a road, you're going to get a lot of noise. And then, of course, air transport. If you're near somewhere like Heathrow, you're going to end up with an awful lot of noise. So that's a problem. Then local pollution. Till recently, we drove cars that had lead in them as an anti-knocking agent. That's largely died out. There are still a few cars that run on lead, and there are still places you can get it, but it's not very much. But actually, the lead is still largely in the soils of the roads because it doesn't disappear very quickly. I've actually done some work on that, and it sticks to the soil particles very strongly, so it will take quite a long time before we cease to have the lead there in the roadside soils. Of more recent interest is particulates and nitrogen oxides. About 8 years ago, we bought our latest car. We've always been people that try to buy cars and then last a long time, so we've had it for 8 years, and at the time we bought what was said to be a really environmentally friendly option, a diesel car, because it was said to be low in carbon emissions, which it is. It was very green and all of that, And so, you know, we've had it all this time, and now, of course, diesel cars are definitely not the end thing. And the reason is that nitrogen oxides, and particularly particulates, very much the case in cities like London, we've got really serious problems with those. So we're going to, the next car we get, and we're kind of hoping that we might jump to electric, but we'll have to see what our situation is in the next couple of years. But we won't be going, that for sure, we won't be going back to a diesel as the next car, and it will be as environmentally friendly as we can get it. Transport, domestic transport in the UK contributes about a quarter of UK carbon emissions. It actually peaked about 10 years ago, as you can see, and has been dropping slowly ever since. In terms of the total carbon emissions, though, total carbon emissions of this country are going down very quickly because we're closing a lot of our coal power plants. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I saw this rather wonderful news that the last time we had carbon emissions that we got in 2016 was 1896. So we've got down to the levels of carbon dioxide emissions that we had in 1896, which is really incredible. Largely through closing coal. But transport, they reckon, is going to be much more difficult to beat in terms of carbon emissions. And that means, of course, that if everything else is closing down and transport's only going slowly, it's going to become a bigger and bigger portion of our carbon emissions in this country. So it is going to be very important in the future that we get off fossil fuels. Now, these graphs are really very complicated, and I'll try and do them simply. This is carbon intensity of travel, and some of it is a little bit surprising. Carbon intensity of travel in terms of carbon dioxide equivalent, so it's not just carbon dioxide because we release other gases as well, which also have greenhouse effects. So carbon dioxide equivalent per passenger kilometre. Per passenger kilometre. And you'll get some surprising things here, like the large car is just about beating the long flight in terms of carbon intensity. And then the medium car comes down there, and you can see how it drops down to the Eurostar rail right at the bottom there. There are some interesting features of this. You might notice that if you're on a long flight in business class, your carbon emissions, your carbon intensity is greater than if you are stuck in the economy class. It's just basically because you squeeze more people into that space. So you can see the overall effect. Now, what you need to remember, though, is why flying is such a problem. It's not these carbon intensity problems, but because we go a long distance very quickly. A long distance very quickly, and we release a lot of carbon as a result of doing that. You'll notice right down the bottom there, Eurostar Rail, and lots of my green friends have said, right, you know, the thing to do is Eurostar Rail. And I've done it. In fact, I did it last year, you know, trying to avoid flying as much as possible. But you have to remember that Eurostar Rail is almost entirely powered by French nuclear electricity, powered by nuclear power. And nuclear power has its own environmental problems. And so, you know, whichever way you go with this transport game, it's not always as clear-cut what's actually the best. You can see electric cars coming in there, sort of in the middle of carbon intensity. Let's look at a different way. This is the second one. And you can see automotive there. Let's look at the pink. And you can see, obviously, the big cars have bigger emissions. But you can see the more people that you put into your car, the more efficient it is. So driving with just one person in is not a good plan, and that's why car sharing is very important. Then look in the middle, you can see public and public transport is first. And actually those are not bad, provided that you actually have reasonably packed buses, reasonably packed trains. If they're sort of the average sort of average number of people on buses and trains where they aren't actually full, then the carbon emissions are not as good. Then you look at the flying on the right, and there are two things to note there. Number one is that the short-haul flights are less efficient than the long-haul, largely because you use an awful lot of energy to get off the ground. That's where an awful lot of the fuel goes, is getting off the ground in the first place. You'll notice also that they've added in an extra light blue bar called radiative forcing. And that is because it isn't just the carbon dioxide that's released from plane flights which causes climate change. Those contrails that you see, that's putting a lot of water into the upper atmosphere. It's also putting other gases and things into the upper atmosphere. And it's reckoned to possibly double the effect of the carbon dioxide. So quite serious issue there. So you can see where flying comes out on this. And you can see it's quite a bit higher, but compared with some of the automobile efforts, it depends on how many people you've got in your car, really. But obviously public transport wins if you've got a fairly packed train or bus. What about road transport? The electric car. This is what we would like to be going to next. The electric car. Some of our friends have started going to electric cars. Some of you will have heard of Ruth Valerio, the Arosha UK, now gone to Tearfun, and she's just taken delivery of her Nissan Leaf and is very pleased with it. And Margot's brother Mike, who's also a vicar, is getting his and Nissan Leaf as well. So we're thinking, we've got to head in this direction. The problems at the moment with them are the range. Ruth is reckoning she'll get a range of about 110 miles. The second problem is how long it takes to charge up the batteries. And the third problem is that they're still pretty expensive. So you've got these problems that you've got to get around, but it seems to be the way to go. It is true that since 2013, there has been a massive increase in purchase of electric cars in this country. So we are seeing quite a revolution. And you will see these charging points all over the place. We've got one at our station at Haddenham. We saw lots in Birmingham where we were doing our conference a couple of weeks ago. So it's on the increase, there is no doubt. We need it to be. Actually, in terms of renewables, batteries are where the really big thing is. That's where it is. In terms of, you've probably all heard the argument about wind turbines and solar. If we don't have any wind, we don't have any sun, no use, right? Well, but if you've got really good batteries, you can overcome that because you store it when you have got the wind and when you've got the solar, and then you can release it to the grid later. In fact, in California, in the end of last year, three massive plants, one built by Tesla, Southern California, battery plants for doing just that. So it's on the way. It's also very important in cars. And you can see it's the expense of the battery which is making up a lot of the expense of the car. It's dropped, though, really quite markedly from 1,000 to less than 400 in just 5 years. So you can get the idea. Things are improving. The batteries are going to be the key critical thing in this whole area. And there is this problem of how long it takes to charge. Ruth said her Nissan Leaf is going to take about half an hour to charge up, which is not too bad, but it's an awful lot longer than you will take to put petrol in your car if you're going up the motorway. But these guys, there is some very recent research where they reckon they might be able to get batteries that will charge up within just a few minutes. If you can do that, then you really are onto a winner. If you can extend the range, you can bring the price of the batteries down, you can get the charge to go. I've got a feeling that within 10 years, this is all going to happen. Flying. Probably the most controversial area of this whole topic. The Bishop of London, about 10 years ago, Richard Charters, who of course has recently retired as Bishop of London, made a very controversial statement, which is probably the one thing that everybody, even secular people, remember him for. There is now an overriding imperative to walk more lightly upon the earth, and we need to make our lifestyle decisions in that light. Making selfish choices such as flying on holiday or buying a large car are a symptom of sin. Sin is not just a restricted list of moral mistakes. It is living a life turned in on itself where people ignore the consequences of their actions. It was a very controversial statement at the time. It got in all of the newspapers. It made lots and lots of noise. Richard Charters has been one of the leading bishops in this whole area and has done a fantastic job. And he's going to be seriously missed, although I expect he'll still be doing some environmental stuff. I hope so, anyway. Where do we go, though? That's 10 years ago. What's actually happened? Well, I know lots of Christians and non-Christians who don't fly. I know some who stopped flying, maybe are flying again now. I know some in that category. I know some that, for their work, are flying all the time. And it's very difficult. It's a very difficult issue. We personally, I have a personal kind of problem, is that my brother and my only family live in California. You know, what do you do? We did stop visiting for a while, but we decided to go once every 2 years to California to visit him and his family. Because that's my only family, really seriously, in the, so, quite a difficult one. And then there are work trips and things like that. So, it's difficult. That's where we've come to. We try to reduce flying as much as we can, but we certainly haven't stopped. So, what are the options on flying? Well, one could decide that you were going to try to ban it. I don't think that's going to work, to be honest. A global ban on flying, you're not going to persuade all the governments of the world to do it. You can try to persuade people to stop or to reduce it, and that has had some effect. I know there are some people who have decided to stop totally, and I admire them for it. You can make it expensive by putting tax on it, or by actually, of course, the fuel is subsidised, so if you took off some of that subsidy, you could actually make it more expensive. snag with that is, what it would mean is that we'd probably go back to something more like the 1950s, where the rich people would all fly still and the poorer people would not be able to afford to. The third one, which I think is the possibly the best option, is to make it more sustainable. How are we going to do that? Make it more sustainable. And then fourthly, added to that, offsetting. Offsetting as an option. It might surprise you to know that actually the aircraft and airline industry is very keen on trying to work out how they're going to deal with this sustainability problem, because they know that sooner or later really big legislation is going to come in to hit them, and it's beginning to wind its way up. Trump accepted, it's winding its way up, and sooner or later they are going to get hit, so they are going to need to do things. And you can see that just doing things like technical operations and infrastructure measures can bring down the amount of emissions straight away. You might have noticed the difference that on most flights nowadays, if you go on a flight, then nearly all the seats are occupied. 20 years ago, you get on a flight and far less people. Last week, Margot actually spotted interesting article where they're looking at rerouting the flights so that they don't have such an effect on the upper atmosphere, because there are ways of routing things that you don't have such an effect. So there's all kinds of those kind of things. And then there's biofuels. You can add biofuels in and use biofuels, and quite a number of airlines around the world, there's United, there's Alaska, there's KLM, are all interested and are using biofuels at least as part of their mix. And you can see the idea is a very green one, where you actually take the waste from what we stick out in our bins, you digest it and turn it into biofuel, which you then use for your planes. And in fact, British Airways and the UK government were intending to actually go in for a big project on that until the last election, when the government decided to pull out of doing that, which was a bit sad. But there is a lot of interest in biofuels in terms of air transport, and I think that is a way forward. Electric planes. Yeah, really. The batteries are getting better and better and better. The plan is that for short-haul flights, at any rate, in 10 years' time, we'll be able to do London to Paris in an electric plane. And what they're thinking is that, assuming the batteries get us better at the same rate they are now, by 10 years we'll have powerful enough batteries to be able to do this. And essentially what you do is you charge the batteries up on the ground, and then you use them as modules, and so you're not charging on the plane. You don't plug the plane in, you just change the batteries and then off you go again. Be great, yeah. And you could, of course, then do it with use solar or wind to produce the electricity. And it's a way forward. Last year, Solar Impulse 2 managed to go all the way around the world with solar panels. That was great. It was a huge technological achievement to do that, but it only had one person with huge wings. Realistically, all of the readings I've done for this suggest that we're not going to be able to do big passenger planes with the currently available technology. Now, what happens in the future, I don't know. But at the moment, that doesn't look likely to be an option for this. But electricity, electric planes do look quite technically feasible, and certainly biofuels is already happening. And then offsetting. A few years back, I was asked to be the temporary CEO of Climate Stewards, which is one of the Arosha family of projects. And I did that for a year, because I said I would do it for a year to help them out. And now Caroline Pomeroy has taken over, and she's been doing a great job on this whole idea of offsetting. So the idea is you think about your lifestyle, as you can see, you reduce what you can, so you don't fly if you can avoid it, you go on trains or whatever, and then you offset the rest. And then they will then go and plant some trees for you in a lot of them in Africa, in Ghana and Kenya. And that is a way of at least partially restoring the things that you're doing through going on a flight or whatever. So there is a possibility for you, offsetting. Right, we're just right on time. A small book plug. We were actually asked by Mike because to bring along a bookstall because he advertised a whole lot of the things on the website. Very kind. Thank you, Mike, for advertising our books. Just three of them that I'll highlight for you. The first is A Christian Guide to Environmental Issues, which Margot and I wrote. And that looks at all, more or less all environmental issues, but we concentrate on eight. So we look at biodiversity loss, we look at climate change, we look at water, we look at energy. We didn't look at transport, although it comes in various ways, you can imagine, in energy and so on. So I do the kind of issues, and then Margot looks, gives a theological and ethical reflection. And we have Bible studies. This is intended as an entry-level book, really. And it's got lots of nice stories and all of that. We write, we like to write stories in our books that they don't become too heavy. An Introduction to Environmental Ethics is new. Both the other two came out this year, 2017. That's a little bit more heavyweight. It's not impossible to read, but it's looking at the value of nature. It's looking at how we value nature and the different views that there are on that. And so we've included the web resources. Actually, it says $3.95 there, but we've actually printed out the web resources, so we'll sell them for £4 to give us a bit for the printing. Of the web resources in the back. And then on the 20th of January this year, which was Donald Trump's inauguration, the organisation that I work for, the John Ray Initiative, brought out a briefing, which I wrote, on Donald Trump and the environment. Of course, that keeps coming up and has come up very recently in the news, and his whole approach to climate change. And I think if you're interested in current issues and what is likely to happen with Trump, then I think that's one for you. I will bang on time, hand over to Margot.
Well, good evening. Listening to Martin's talk, my first ever car, my dad was a caraholic and I learnt to drive at 17 and had a little mini traveller when I was 20. And it felt ecological because it had the moss along, you know, do you remember those? The moss along the windows. But our aim now, I'm really love to get an electric car. But what I'd like is a kind of solar panel across the roof and on the bonnet. And I think that would just be perfect. A few years back, in America, could only be in America, says they ran a bumper sticker campaign called What Would Jesus Drive? WWJD was not What Would Jesus Do, but What Would Jesus Drive? And if you had a dirty car, and I don't expect around here you ever have dirty cars, they're all wonderfully clean, but if you had a dirty car and it was parked somewhere, you'd sometimes get sort of, you know, into the dust, you'd see there were two things people said. Either the answer was a donkey, or it was a VW camper van, because it's economic, it's humble, and you can get the 12 disciples in the back. So, in reflecting on transport from a Christian perspective, it's just good to ask, how does God see travel and how does God use travel? And I thought I'd look at that more than some of the sort of general ideas and biblical approaches to how we care for environment, because I think you've had quite a lot of that in other sessions. So I'm looking a little bit about how does God see travel? What is there about travel in the Bible? Well, God's call to Abraham. There are lots of journeys in the Bible. And with Abraham, God called him to leave home. Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. Now, there isn't any indication in the Bible that he needed to move. There wasn't any persecution there, which happens in many other circumstances. Now, we know from archaeology that Mesopotamia was a thriving civilization at the point. It's quite possible that population was on the rise, indeed quite probable that population was on the rise, and it may have been that that was causing people to think about migrating and moving and looking elsewhere. But we don't know. As far as the people around him were concerned, he wasn't a pilgrim following God's call. He would have been an economic migrant trying to make his way up around the Fertile Crescent and down, sort of skirting around the desert in the middle. So that's Abraham, one of the first big migrations that you see in the Bible. And then there are an awful lot of forced migrations, if you think about it, in the Bible. That first one I put up in the top left is Joseph. Joseph with his multicoloured coat getting trafficked to Egypt, but later providing a home for his father, his brothers and their families when they were fleeing famine and looking for a place to live, something that still happens very, very much today, where there are places of famine and people start to travel, to move, to look for somewhere to live. Oh, sorry, I'm still talking about this one. Moses, who led a group of refugees out of Egypt, fleeing forced labour, fleeing slavery, to look for their own land. And then this one here, the exile into Babylon, when people were taken as captives after a military victory and taken into slavery. And then finally here, Mary and Joseph, again fleeing persecution into Egypt. So all of these were, to some extent, forced migrations. Some were fleeing persecution, others were fleeing captivity, others were fleeing famine. Some of those resonate with quite a lot of the migrations that we see today in our world, a lot of the migrants that are pouring into Europe. So forced migrations. Then there's an awful lot of movement of goods, economic movement. The supply chain was around and was alive and well in the biblical era. There's not a lot that's put about that. I mean, it's kind of almost in the backdrop of what was going on. We can read about the building of the temple in Kings and Chronicles, where they got cedar and other wood from Lebanon. They got gold from somewhere, and there would have been other things that they were bringing in. And you read about Solomon and his wealth and all sorts of things. It was pouring into the economy at that time. If you remember that Fertile Crescent with that the map that I gave with Abraham, Canaan, Israel, Palestine was on a huge crossroads for trade. It was where Africa and Europe and Asia meet. And so it's a massive trade route. And there was an awful lot going through, all the way through biblical times, spices particularly, but other goods, cloth, valuables, such as silver, gold, other things. All sorts of things would have travelled through that area. And you see that going right through to New Testament times. One of the reasons some biblical scholars think that Jesus moved to Capernaum was that it was on these trade routes. And it was a place where it was busier than Nazareth. There was more going on. Then pilgrimage, which I think for most ordinary people was the time when they travelled. And in the biblical calendar, you travel 3 times a year to go up to the temple. In the autumn, you have the autumn festivals that start with Rosh Hashanah, New Year, and go on to the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. And that was a big time to travel up to the temple. Jesus was asked by his brothers to go up then, if you remember, and didn't go up publicly, went up privately, but was later at the festival. It's when he gave the great statements about light of the world, and if anyone is thirsty, that links closely to that festival. Passover time in the spring, we're coming up to now, where you saw those pilgrimages of Jesus going up with his parents, getting left behind because he was so busy talking to the rabbis, typical 12-year-old, you know, so excited. He was so engaged with it all. And then Pentecost, which is an Old Testament festival, and celebrates the harvest, the early harvest, the grain harvest, but also is the date when Moses was given the law. And the date when he was up on Mount Sinai. And so it's again a festival when people would go to Jerusalem to worship and to remember the giving of the covenant and also to bring some of their offerings for their first fruits. So all sorts of things would be happening, and people from around that area would travel in. By New Testament times, Jewish people were very dispersed, and they might travel. It might be a once in a lifetime to travel up to Jerusalem, and it might take a very long time. It might be by ship, by horse, by foot, by all sorts of things. And that would also be the case for Paul on his missionary journeys. Paul took advantage of the Roman road system, which was kind of HS2 of first century, which is going through one of my parishes, sadly. There we go. But Paul travelled on his missionary journeys by horse, by boat, by foot, and he used that transport system to bring the message of the gospel to the communities around, to those people. And he travelled extensively. It's amazing when you look at his journeys. So what is all the potential from this journey? What is the result of it? Well, much of the travel in the Bible is not a daily thing. It's not like daily commuting to work. It's a special time. You've got that migrating, whether it's forced or unforced. You've got the festivals. You've got the missionary journeys. And in all of those journeyings, you're actually meeting with God in a new way. It's a time when discipleship was deepened. It's a time when people got more mature in their faith, when they became more open to new ideas because they're travelling from one place to another and it made them open. It's when you move and you go to new places, have new experiences, that you're often more open to things. There were also problems. There was dislocation and isolation. There was syncretism. There was danger from bandits and robbers. was quite possibly materialism, particularly in Solomon's day. When you look at the temple and what happened, you do wonder what was going on there. It does seem that that wealth became more important than worshipping God at some times. And wealth led to inequality as well. And then finally, it was very tiring. When you think about, think about poor old Mary and all her travels around, and she was heavily pregnant at the time. But it was a very tiring thing. Travel wasn't seen as a joy. I mean, travel is linked to the word travail, whereas many people see travel as a kind of, you go on holiday or something. It wasn't that thought. Travel was seen as something that was quite hard work. So just to bring all of that to a little bit of a conclusion, God does call people to move, because you can meet with God in a new way. It can aid your discipleship. It can open you up to new ideas. But the travel has a purpose. It's been God's way of focusing people to live their lives and to commit themselves more to Him. The picture I've got up there is Naomi and Ruth. And it was Ruth's desire to support her mother-in-law that led her on that, and again, another forced migration in time of famine, to move elsewhere. So what relevance does it have for a Lent course on environmental issues in terms of the Bible? I mean, this has been, quite a spiritual journey that I've found in looking at travel in the Bible. Looking directly through the lens of travel, there's not much on sustainability. I mean, the emissions from a donkey aren't quite the same as the emissions. We did once have a group of girls. They were environmental suffragettes, weren't they, or something? I better not mention suffragettes here, I'm told. But they came and camped on our green. I'd only just become vicar. And one was the daughter of somebody who'd gone off to be vicar somewhere else. And they came and camped on our green, and they were incredibly green. They went off up to into the Cotswolds, and they dumped that. And they're all in horses and carts. They didn't have cars or anything like that. They dumped their emissions from these horses on Jeremy Clarkson's lawn. which I think he then put it on his roses, so it didn't quite have the effect they were hoping for. What is going on in all of this? Well, I think you have to say biblical travel is actually more to do with migrating, to do with festivals, to do with trade. That's what where you see travel if you start looking at the Bible. It is much less often a daily thing. It's not this sort of hurtling around the country and hurtling back again that has become so much a feature of our lives. Particularly, I think, here in the southeast. Now, we live in a village. People know our village because it's Haddenham and Tame Parkway. And it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. 7 o'clock in the morning, the station is absolutely jam-packed. And since our line opened up to Oxford, which is great for us for going out, it's got even more packed. And we're wondering how much Marylebone Station can take, really. And I see here you've got your, similar situation, I think, and I'm sure your station is equally busy. It's not always possible in our culture to live near work, and that commuting culture is very, very real. But I think there is something in the biblical narrative that you actually look and life, general daily life, was not a time with big travel. So where you can live your life, where you're actually minimising travel on a day-to-day basis, it can be a good thing. It does help community. If you kind of live your life more in one place, it helps community. Now, that's not possible for everybody, but that does help when you can do it. Then when you use travel, you use it more in that biblical way, to meet with God. So a pilgrimage type thing, which might be holiday. It might be seeing relatives. It might be something that is somewhere that's going to deepen your time with God. And what I kind of got to, and I've not done a reflection on travel before, but what I kind of got to was actually thinking, well, maybe why don't we commit ourselves to use travel to try and get closer with God, you know, to listen to the Sunday sermon on our earphones or something as we're commuting to London, or to, you know, have it as part of our quiet time or something like that, so that we actually deepen that time. But I think for me, that was where I came to, that we actually try to cut down where we can on that hurtlingness that is part of our lives, and try and use travel wisely, less often, but for something that will be really significant. Right, I will just put the final slide up, which is some contact information, which you're welcome to have. Thank you very much.